Greetings once again. My name is Doug McBurney, and you may have heard the news, but stand by now for the Worldview. That's right, it's the Weekly Worldview, and I am your host, Doug McBurney, coming to you from a mile high, looking down on all of it. Glad to be with you this week on the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do focus on the events of the week through the lens of original thought, and I am joined in studio, as usual, by my extremely attractive audio engineer. So glad to have her here, and so glad to have you on board. Did I already say that? I already said that. I don't know whether to start with O.J. Simpson or Michio Kaku. You familiar with this Michio Kaku fellow? The first thing you say is atheist? Is that the first thing that comes to your mind? All right, so we're off talk radio here at the McBurney compound. At least I am for the last couple of weeks. But we are not off science-type television. So we bump over to Secrets of the Earth. Earlier last week. Yeah, I know. You fell asleep, but I was watching. My extremely attractive audio engineer finds any discussion of rocks, space, hydroplates. She nods off. But I was very interested. Michio Kaku was, they were talking about electromagnetic pulse and global, worldwide, catastrophic loss of electricity, food riots, all of that stuff. And it's like a car accident. You bump by that on your remote, and you just have to stop and listen because, I mean, it's global, worldwide catastrophe, and I don't know what it is that's so fascinating about that, but there's certainly something fascinating about it. And I found one thing that Michio Kaku said that was interesting. By the way, Michio Kaku, I don't know what his actual designation or credentials are, except, yeah, that atheist guy who's always on there talking about evolution and the Big Bang. And yeah, aliens. That's his big thing, too, aliens. So anyway, he talks about a global, a sun spot, an eruption from the sun that the Earth's magnetic field cannot handle, and it just burns out and knocks everything out. And suddenly the entire world is 1831, all of a sudden. No electricity. No communication. All of our satellites are melted down, probably crashing to the Earth. And he compares that to blackouts that we've experienced here. I think he talked about one on the East Coast back in the 70s. Anyway, he makes the comment that in regional blackouts and catastrophes, natural disasters, there is some hope for recovery because there is still help possible from the outside, but in a worldwide catastrophic sunspot-related EMP, there would be no such help from the outside. And then he predicted the food riots and the zombie invasion and zombies. People slaughtering each other, butchering each other, killing each other, stealing the food. And I want to remind Michio Kaku that even if there were a global catastrophic electromagnetic event that knocked out all electricity, all communication, and basically left us all stranded on our own little Idaho, that there still would be help available from the outside, Michio, because there is a God in heaven above, and there would be people on the earth who would begin to call upon the name of the Lord, and there would not necessarily be only massive food riots and warfare. There would be people who reached out to the outside to call down help from the Almighty, and He would help us. And in the morning after the EMP, well, some of us might engage in food riots, but some of us might start fixing things. So there is help from the outside, but not as far as Michio Kaku knows, because he's an atheist. And he'd probably be the one kicking down your door with a pitchfork trying to steal your lettuce out of your garden. Anyway, my extremely attractive audio engineer fell asleep, and I moved on to another channel, and I watched I'm not sure what I watched. I might have went to sleep at that point, too. But anyway, 2 weeks with no talk radio, and I feel like I'm a better person for it. Yeah, I feel like I'm a better person. Let's go into the news now. I want to start first in the justice file with someone who I'm somewhat tangentially related to, and that's O.J. Simpson. Me and O.J., we go back to around 1998 when radio host Bob Enyart and I and some others purchased a number of pieces of his memorabilia and then burned them in a press conference on the steps of the L.A. County Courthouse to protest the state of justice in America. And kind of been following O.J. ever since. And O.J.'s in the news. The Arizona newspaper, Arizona Central, reports that O.J. Simpson is planning on converting to Islam. Yes. Now, you all know that O.J.'s been in prison out there in Nevada ever since he kicked in the door of that hotel room and had his friend stuck that gun in somebody's face. Yeah, he was charged with kidnapping and armed robbery, and he's been in prison there. And there's a good chance he'll die in prison. If you've seen him lately, he looks all puffed up, and he doesn't look good. Well, he's been languishing in prison, and he did a hearing to try to get out on parole, and they denied that. So he's going to serve at least another 4 years in prison. And if you've seen the way he looks, I mean, odds are he's not going to make another 4 years. I mean, Joan Rivers might last longer than O.J. Simpson at this point, if you've seen how bad he looks. Nothing against Joan Rivers. You know, she's in a coma. Did you know she's in a coma? No idea. Yeah, Joan Rivers in a coma, whoever she is. All right. But O.J., he may not last the 4 years, so he's starting to think about squaring up with the Almighty. And he's befriended, apparently, Mike Tyson, former heavyweight champion of the world and current maniac, weirdo, freak, and apparently a Muslim. Now, I think I may have heard that Mike Tyson was a Muslim, but it just never stuck in my... I just never retained that knowledge. I was kind of surprised by this. So Mike Tyson has gotten him interested in Islam. And apparently O.J., according to insiders in the prison there in Nevada, O.J. has been studying the Quran, but he failed to successfully fast during the holy month of Ramadan.
That's why he's so cooking.
Yeah, yeah. That's a matter of fact. One of the insiders in the prison says O.J. kind of cheated during the day, and he bought snacks from the prison canteen. But he's really serious about converting to Islam. This insider says that O.J. is attracted to Islam because he likes the idea that upon converting to Islam, all of his previous sins are forgiven. Did you know that about Islam? I wasn't aware of that. That's a pretty dramatic difference between Islam and Christianity. You see, when you... I'm not going to use the word convert to Christianity because convert is such a temporal idea. When you put your faith and trust in Jesus Christ, all of your sins are forgiven. Past, present, future. There's nothing that can separate you from the love of God at that point. Now, in Islam, it's apparently a little different. Converting to Islam only takes care of your previous sins. See, and then you keep on sinning, and you got to do something, and what do? Well, you've got to serve the mighty Allah. And now, Mike Tyson, they say Mike Tyson is a devout Muslim. They say he's devout. Now, I don't know how devout he is, but he has bitten off a person's ear, but as far as I know, he has not chopped off anyone's head. And I think that's one of the qualifications for being a devout Muslim, is it not? That you have to cut off an infidel's head? I'd have to look it up in my Quran. Let me grab my copy of the Holy Quran, he said, tongue in cheek. I don't have a copy. Anyway, I think maybe the day O.J. converts to Islam, he'll be considered a more devout Muslim than Tyson, because O.J. Simpson actually has done some beheading in his career. Right? I mean, O.J.'s halfway there toward the 72 virgins or whatever it is they get. Anyway, that's the O.J. Simpson news that we open with this week. And, of course, we hope that O.J. Simpson would not die in prison and then go straight to hell with jet rockets, that he would somehow convert, but the odds are definitely against that at this point. You'd think that a man facing his own mortality, well, I don't know. OJ does not want to bow his knee, and he does not want to surrender his will to anyone's. And Allah apparently has a workaround that whole thing, and OJ finds that more attractive. And, well, I just don't understand. But while OJ and Mike Tyson have laid out their strategy going forward, they're going with Allah, Barry Ho has no strategy, and he even said that in front of God and everyone on TV last week. I've got a story here from, I hate the name of this website, The Daily Beast. It just creeps me out. Why would you call your website The Daily Beast? You don't go in the basement and they summon up the beast in the evenings or something. Anyway, from The Daily Beast, which I believe is the leftovers of either Newsweek magazine or, I don't recall. Anyway, they say that President Obama said last Thursday that he is not planning to significantly expand the war against the Islamic State anytime soon. The Daily Beast reports that there was a heated debate inside Barry's national security bureaucracy as to whether or not the United States should strike ISIS in Syria. A heated debate, they say. And the heated debate failed to produce a consensus battle plan. So you have a bunch of academic eggheads and girls in a room, girls who've never plotted any kind of military strategy. They've done some community organizing. You know, they've been to Planned Parenthood fundraisers, but they have not plotted a strategy for war against an implacable enemy hell-bent on their destruction. And so they were not able to produce a consensus battle plan. And Obama told Reuters, he told reporters right after this marathon heated session, he uttered the words, "Well, we don't have a strategy yet," he said in that tan. He's wearing the tan sport coat. You see that? I think that's a sign. You know, like Al-Qaeda and the Islamists, they release these videos. And experts look in the videos for these signs that maybe there's a secret hidden sign in his ring or in his watch or in the way he moves his head or maybe in some of the words he uses. I think Barry's giving a sign to Al-Qaeda with the beige sport coat. He's like, "Hey, I'm kicking back, guys. You know, do whatever you want. Run wild. Sure, I'll drop some bombs. You know, I got fundraising to do. We got midterms. But hey, I'm chilling out. I'm taking it easy, boys." And the Islamic State rages on. Can you believe he said that? We have no strategy yet? I mean, even if you have no strategy and you're trying to get one together, I wouldn't say that in public. I've been in many situations where I didn't have a strategy, but I didn't say that to the people I needed to be strategizing against. I held those cards a little closer to my chest until I came up with a strategy. And then I announced that boldly as if I had the strategy the whole time. And then I crushed and destroyed my enemies. Actually, I never crushed and destroyed my enemies, have I? I'm working on that. I'll get back to you on that. All right. More from the Daily Beast. They say that to many outside the administration who have worked on the Syria and Islamic State problem, Obama's decision not to decide will have I have to try and say this with a straight face because the Daily Beast, it's obvious the writer here is not joking, the reporter. He says Obama's decision not to decide will have negative implications for the war against the Islamic State. Okay, you think? I think he might be right. And many outsiders believe that this is the case. Who was it who said? It was Neil Peart. He said, "If you choose not to decide, you still have made a choice." Truer words have rarely been spoken, especially by a drummer who was on like vodka and pills and stuff at the time.
Canada.
A Canadian, by the way. A Canadian, no less. Anyway, no, we don't know that Neil Peart was on any pills or any vodka at the time that he wrote that song. But we don't know what Obama's on, but man, is it problematic. Inside the administration, the Daily Beast reports, some officials in the heated debate They advocated a campaign to decimate ISIS in both countries, Iran and Syria, with some coordination with the moderate Syrian rebels. So here's the two problems. Number one, a leader does not seek necessarily a consensus strategy. A leader develops a strategy and implements it. He takes advice from other people, but you need a leader to come up with a strategy. And second of all, if you want to destroy the Islamic State, the last thing you can rely on are moderate Syrian rebels, because they're all Muslims too, and you can't rely on them, and you can't rely on the Kurds, and you can't rely on any of those people in any parts of those countries. You got to go in, you got to take them out, you got to kill them all, and you got to start building missions. View. Thank you, Neil, Getty, and the boys. Appreciate that. Punctuation here at the Weekly Worldview. That was the live version, by the way. 1999, I think. We'd have to go back and check the archives, but let's move on. Barry, in the midst of announcing to the world that he has no strategy except the tan sport coat, that's the only significant decision that came out of the meeting with the girl troika that runs the country, Valerie Jarrett. And I think Barry's mother-in-law has a lot more influence than you might think. His fashion-challenged wife, she's involved. There's some other girls I'm missing, too. It's more than a troika, apparently. Anyway, on the heels of having no strategy, now he says, what did he say? He said last Friday, Barry says, The Hill reports that Barry said social media and the nightly news are partly to blame for the sense that, quote, the world is falling apart. So he announces he has no strategy, and then he announces that the world is falling apart. Or at least that there's a sense that that's happening. And it makes you wonder, how much longer can we go on like this before someone realizes that there's literally no leadership left in the Western world? I mean, are our hopes going to fall upon David Cameron in England? Is that what we've come down to? At least he called off his vacation and went home and is preparing and throwing up the drawbridge against the hordes there in the United Kingdom, because they're convinced they're going to be attacked. And so I guess that's it. We're down to David Cameron, and Barry he's a no-show. Anyway, Barry was busy last week, don't get me wrong. He was speaking at a group of political fundraiser donors at a Democrat National Committee barbecue in the ironically named Purchase, New York. That's right, a Democrat fundraiser in Purchase, New York. I found that ironic, what can I say? He said he dismissed the notion that he was facing unprecedented challenges. He did acknowledge the barbarity of the Islamist militants and Russia. So he lumps the Russians in with the Islamo-Nazi fascists who cut off people's heads. Now, I just don't... Well, we're going to get to Russia here in a minute. But so Barry obviously doesn't know what's going on. He equates ISIS and Russia as similar in levels of barbarity, proving that Barry doesn't understand barbarity. But he dismissed the notion that he was facing unprecedented challenges. And The Hill reports a quote from Obama to the group of donors gathered in Purchase, New York. Barry said, "The world has always been messy. We're just noticing it now in part because of the social media." Is that right, Barry? That's like people who say, "Hey, you know, crime isn't really any worse than it was in the 50s. It's just back then we didn't have 24-hour news channels, and we didn't have the media reporting all the time. No, that's not true. Barry, the challenges we are facing under your hapless leadership are unprecedented. That they are unprecedented. We have a fanatic Islamo-fascist state that has decreed that they will expand and conquer the world. Now, nobody's ever let that happen before. I mean, we've allowed them to take over a couple of backwater third world hellholes like Afghanistan from time to time, and that was a mistake. But here, they're on the march, and they've announced their goal. That hasn't happened before. Another thing that hasn't happened before, Barry, is with you and the homosexuals. I cannot, in my amateur position as a historian and in researching, I cannot find another civilization that has worked so hard to declare sin and crime as good and just and righteous. And that's what America is doing under Barack Obama. Not only are the leaders and the kings and the princes and the presidents and the senators, not only are they engaging in wicked, sinful, destructive behavior, but they're seeking to codify it in law for everyone. And even the emperors of Rome didn't do that. They didn't legalize murder and sodomy and all this vile, destructive behavior for everyone. They just engaged in it themselves, like a proper despot. Barack Obama is orders of magnitude more dangerous than even the worst dictators. You know, Adolf Hitler didn't make murder illegal, except when he wanted to use it. And certainly didn't codify homosexual relationships as marriage, as bad as Hitler was. He wasn't that bad, at least on that issue. He was way worse on a number of other issues. But just give Barry time, for crying out loud. Anyway, Barry says, regarding the challenges, according to The Hill, he says, we will get through these challenging times, just like we always have in the past, for... And he teed off. And Barry, here's the thing. In the past, we didn't have a missing in action leader on the golf course. In the past, we had men who came together and led the nation through perilous and challenging times. So to just assume we're just going to get through it like we always have, that's kind of a fifth grade attitude, Barry. It doesn't just happen automatically. All right, I'm going too long on this. I apologize. Now, this fundraiser event that The Hill was reporting on was held in Purchase, New York. And it was the second of three fundraisers that Barry attended just this past Friday. And he was off the golf course, and he was at these fundraisers. He was working hard for the American people. Tickets to the event began at $15,000 per couple there in Purchase, New York. Okay, now speaking of challenges that have occurred during the Obama administration, we certainly don't want to single Barry out, although we are singling him out as the single worst and most dangerous leader in the history of the world, in all nations, the most dangerous. Just give him time. If he's allowed to progress to his natural end game, he'll be worse than all of them. Fox News is reporting that Nidal Hassan, do we all remember him? Yeah, he's the Islamic fanatic who butchered 13 American soldiers, 14 if you count the unborn child who was killed there at Fort Hood. Fox News calls him the convicted shooter in the Fort Hood massacre. So do you get that? How they just never use anything that... They should have said the Fort Hood killer. They could have said a number of things, but they say the convicted shooter in the Fort Hood massacre. It just bothers me, okay? The way they report things. And I forget there's a term for this type of language. It's indirect. Never direct. It never gets to the point. Well, this convicted shooter in the Fort Hood massacre has written a letter to the leader of the Islamic State saying he wants to become a citizen of the new caliphate. Yes. Hassan, Listen to how Fox reports this. And this is Fox News, who some of you people think is conservative. It's just CNN with transgendered chicks hiking up their skirts. That's all Fox News is. Now, I'll leave that aside. I don't want to offend you, but that's just my opinion of Fox News. They say that Nidal Hassan, who fatally shot 13 people and injured more than 30 at Fort Hood in 2009, he killed 13. He murdered 13 people. He butchered 13 people. They could have put it any other way. They could have put it a number of other ways, but they put it in the, he fatally shot. As if he was one step removed from what happened. He fatally shot 13 and injured? Nidal Hassan was acting on behalf of the Islamists who we've been fighting for almost 15 years. He wounded more than 30. This was an act of war. Anyway, the Obama Defense Department has called the fatal shooting in the Fort Hood massacre workplace violence. But anyway, Hassan wrote this letter to Ibrahim Amanaman Baghdadi. I don't know what his name is. And he wants to be a citizen. And this news comes, according to Fox News, after two Americans reportedly died fighting for the Islamic State in Syria. That's right. Abdirahman Muhammad of Minneapolis and Douglas MacArthur McCain of Minneapolis both reportedly died. Douglas MacArthur McCain grew up outside Minneapolis but had recently been living in San Diego. And he looked around and he's like, I can't take it. It's 75 degrees all the time. The weather is perfect. The beach is beautiful. I want to go to Syria and join the Islamic State. Here's the thing about young men. Young men need some kind of inspiration, and they need to be part of something big in order to vent and use in a constructive manner all the energy that's just naturally innate in a young man, a young single man. And so they didn't find it in Minneapolis. They didn't find it in San Diego. They didn't find it in the pop culture. They didn't find it in the consumer culture. They apparently couldn't find it in the modern Christian church in America, and they end up going over to Syria and fighting for the Islamic State. As bizarre as it seems in the minds of what we think of ourselves as normal people, a normal person, who would do this? Well, young men need inspiration, and if the Islamic State is offering them more inspiration than the pop culture, the consumer culture, the hookup culture, college, the Christian church, they'll end up in Syria, and these guys ended up in Syria. I believe these guys were Somali. Let me see here. Let's see here. It's been said by an expert there in Minneapolis's Somali community that at least 10 young men from Minneapolis have been recruited to travel to Syria to fight for the Islamic State. He says there is a pipeline from Minneapolis to Islamic Jihad overseas. And just to remind everyone, these are the children of the Somalis that George H.W. Bush rescued from Africa in the 1990s. You remember how good we all felt about that? How we all got a warm, fuzzy feeling of how we were saving all these people out of Somalia as we let them all flood into the country and bring their satanic religion with them? Do you remember that? George H.W. Bush rescued them in the 90s. And they were processed in, imported in, by Bill Clinton, but initially it was George H.W. Bush who began the whole Somali catastrophe that has now ended up with Douglas MacArthur McCain. I mean, you can't make that up in a Hollywood script that Douglas MacArthur McCain would join the Islamic State and fight against us. It's a Alice in Wonderland moment through the looking glass, up is down, right is left, black is white, everything's bizarre. So George H.W. So, and it was George Bush, by the way, who blew the whole Iraqi fiasco, failed to set up a Christian government, and now look what's happened in Iraq. It's dissolved into chaos and murder and an Islamic State. My prediction could be true that the Bushes, both father and son, could go down as the most disastrous presidents in history and two of the stupidest men to ever hold the office of President of the United States. View. McBurney here. Glad to have you aboard. More deeper now into the war file, we have a warning from King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. King Abdullah, the slave trading, child molesting, harem abusing king of Saudi Arabia, is saying that if we ignore the Islamic State, he says, I am sure they will reach Europe in a month. And they will reach America in another month, says King Abdullah. And he should know. Saudi Arabia and the oil money and all the rich child molesting, harem abusing, goat molesting Wahhabists there, they've funded what turned into Al-Qaeda. They've been a part of the whole thing. If anybody knows what's going to happen with ISIS, it's King Abdullah. So we should take his warning seriously. But don't worry, because even though Barry doesn't have a plan, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel and Secretary of State John Kerry are planning to meet with Europeans at a NATO summit in Wales next week, and they're going to ask the Europeans maybe to craft a strategy. So that's it. It's come down to David Cameron, and I guess François Hollande. The communists from France, they're going to save us from the Islamists? Oh, it's worse than I thought. I mean, did you see Chuck Hagel? Was it last week or the week before? When his eyes got all big and he said, this ISIS, they're like nothing we've ever seen. I thought he was going to wet himself right there on TV. He looked terrified. He's our Secretary of Defense. He was watching the videos and he got scared. Oh, no. Chuck Hagel's not the guy. Please. He's not going to be Chuck Hagel, and he's not going to be John Kerry. No. No. Chuck Hagel, I can imagine. Can you imagine if ISIS stormed Chuck Hagel's house? The guy would, I mean, he would just melt into a quivering mass of gelatin. Just sweating and just unbelievable. But anyway, him and Kerry are going to meet with the Europeans, see if they can craft something. The king there in Saudi Arabia, King Abdullah, he urged other countries to join the Uncounterterrorism Center that was set up in 2011, allegedly to respond to terrorist threats. He said, look, Saudi Arabia has made a contribution to the Uncounterterrorism Center for $100 million. Hey! You know, we give some money to the Islamists, we build a lot of mosques in America. The Wahhabists, we've been giving them money for like 50 years. And we've thrown $100,000 into this Uncounterterrorism Center, and we're hoping that all the countries will send their representatives, and then the Saudis can record all their conversations and pass those along to the Wahhabists and the Islamic State. Saudi Arabia makes me sick. All right, now on the Wahhabist Islamist front, of course, you can't report on Islamism without reporting on Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter, according to WorldNet Daily, gave a keynote speech at a fundraiser for a Muslim organization that federal prosecutors and a federal judge says is a front group for the terrorist organization Hamas. It's the Islamic Society of North America. They booked Jimmy Carter as their featured speaker. And he spoke at their Islamist convention there in Detroit on Saturday. There were calls for Carter to pull out, but he couldn't understand why he should, and he went ahead with the speech, and he collected his speaking fee, I'm sure. The Carter Center in Atlanta, which is Jimmy Carter's, I think it's a presidential library, or it's his slush fund that he set up. Similar to the Clinton Fund. Was it the Clinton Global Fund? Big old slush fund they set up afterwards so they can travel the world first class and eat well and act like they're good people. Well, the Carter Center, they defended Carter's speaking role by arguing that he planned to focus on women's rights and plug his new book. That's what it was really about. Come on. Jimmy just need to plug that new book. You know, he's got to move copies out. So, you know, who's more likely to buy Jimmy Carter books than a bunch of Muslims in Detroit? That's his target audience. Those are his buddies. So Jimmy Carter, former president of the United States, speaking to an Islamic organization that has been tied to funneling funds directly to Hamas. Anyway, we shouldn't be surprised. Meanwhile, in Israel, Bibi Netanyahu has a bit of a revolt in his cabinet over his decision to accept an Egyptian ceasefire. Did you all notice that there's been a ceasefire? Yeah, okay, so there's been a ceasefire. The Egyptians talked the Israelis into accepting a temporary, long-term ceasefire with no... Anyway, the people in Netanyahu's cabinet, they're not so upset about the ceasefire. They're upset that Bibi weren't in the loop. So he didn't bring his cabinet into the loop. He just made the decision himself, which is called leadership. Not that I necessarily agree with what Mr. Netanyahu did, but that's what leadership is. It's when the guy who's in charge shuts the door and makes the decision. Now, I believe that Benjamin Netanyahu's decision was a loss in the war against the enemies of Israel because, Bibi, if you're listening, if an enemy sworn to your destruction is still around at the end of the war, if they're still alive and still sworn to your destruction, you have lost. And that's exactly what's happened. Israel has lost yet another significant battle for its survival. And I don't know that it will survive the next one. I wouldn't be surprised if Israel were indeed, as a political entity, just as the Muslims have sworn to do, I would not be surprised if it's not wiped off the map to some degree within the next decade. It wouldn't surprise me at all. Very sad, but typical of Western democracies, the cabinet's all offended that they weren't a part of the decision-making process. They're not offended that they lost another war and that now the Hamas and the Hezbollah are just rearming, getting ready for the next round in a never-ending struggle. It's just sad to see. But now let's move on to Russia, because you heard Barry, who said that the barbarism of the Islamic State in Russia, he equivocated those two. He compared them as if they were similar. And here's a report from the IB Times in the United Kingdom. They say in their headline, "Why is Vladimir Putin referring to Eastern Ukraine as New Russia?" And it's kind of a silly headline because everybody knows why. It's because Putin plans on taking it back. That's why. You don't need to ask the question. It's pretty obvious. They report that Vladimir addressed an address to pro-Russian separatists battling Kiev's forces in eastern Ukraine, in which he referred to the rebels as, quote, the militia of New Russia, or Novorossiya. Novorossiya, which translates as New Russia, is a historical term for a region conquered by the Russian Empire in the 18th century and controlled by the Tsars up until into the 19th century. And in the same address that Putin made to pro-Russian separatists. Putin said, quote, God knows why the new Russian regions became Ukrainian territories in the 1920s. Yeah, and it's interesting. Oh, by the way, Putin's use of the nostalgic term, Novorossiya, rings similar calls of historical ties to the Crimea region before Russian annexed the peninsula. Which, by the way, do we all recall that Putin did that, and he did it, and it's done. And he did it, that's all. He just did it. Why? Because Crimea is a part of Russia. And actually, Kiev, I don't trust the people in Kiev. I don't trust the way that whole thing went down. I don't trust the neo-Nazis who are involved in the takeover of the government. And by the way, before 1991, Ukraine was never an independent nation in and of itself. It's always been someone's territory, mostly Russians. It's been controlled by the Poles. It's been controlled by this and that empire. It was controlled by the czars, but it's always been a state, a part of Russia, generally, or whoever else might have conquered it here and there throughout history. One of the earliest Russian names was Kievan Rus. Kievan Rus, because it was headquartered in Kiev. And in 1245 AD, little history lesson, a papal envoy wrote of Kiev as, quote, the greatest Russian city sacked by the Mongols. Anyway, so if the neo-Nazis want to take over in Ukraine because of the democracy worshippers who insisted that Ukraine be divided off of Russia, that was never going to last. All you democracy worshippers, just because you think the people of Kiev were given self-determination, one man, one vote, all that stuff you worship, it was never going to last. Russia was never going to give up Ukraine, and they're never going to give up Ukraine. And I'm not so sure they should be forced to give up Ukraine, especially to a bunch of neo-Nazi street thugs who took it over. All right, now let's move on. Meanwhile, as the Islamists rage, Putin maneuvers, and the Chinese are always conniving and plotting and scheming. Well, here in America, we are obsessed with other very important matters. The main one, at least this past week, according to the LA Times, is the problem of rape on college campuses, otherwise known as drunken fornication, in all its forms. And apparently the University of California system is set to adopt a standard of unambiguous consent among students engaging in sexual activity, also known as fornication and promiscuity. And you read this whole article. Listen to this. I've got a quote here from a senator, a state senator in California from Los Angeles. Listen to what he says about the state of fornication, promiscuity, and rape on college campuses in California. He says, quote, these are our daughters. They are our sisters. They are our nieces. It is incumbent upon men in particular to step up and stand up and do everything possible to change that culture. That culture that's quite pervasive on our college campuses, that is a rape culture, unquote. So he goes through this very self-righteous assault on this rape culture, but never once does he mention that maybe someone should be telling these kids they should maybe not be having sex until they get married. Maybe they shouldn't fornicate. Maybe they shouldn't be promiscuous. Maybe you shouldn't be a slut, whether you're male or female. Maybe you shouldn't engage in random sexual deviancy. Nobody says that. They just say, you know what? We need a policy so that we know when yes means yes and no means no. After all, these are our daughters. We care about them. Maybe they should send a text message so we have it in writing. These people must hate their children. Anyway, the LA Times reports that students engaging in fornication, they call it sexual activity, people engaging in fornication would first need affirmative consent from both parties, a clear threshold that specifically could not include a person's silence, a lack of resistance, or consent given while intoxicated. So this hapless senator, along with another Senator Hannah there in Santa Barbara, they're writing a Senate bill to address the problem of when yes means yes, and how can we have the kids fornicate in a safe, clean, consensual environment? That's what they want. And you know why they want it? Because these senators plan to visit these colleges, and they'll be there after hours at the bars. And all these college kids will be very, very enthusiastic and impressed with the state senators. And these senators will be cruising these college campuses, and they want to make sure that they're not exposed to any litigation. The LA Times reports that nearly 50 colleges and universities nationwide, including UCLA, USC, and Occidental College, are under federal investigation for their handling of sexual assault allegations. But no one involved, this is me now, this isn't the LA Times, no one involved recognizes a problem with rampant fornication. They never even think, well, that's why you're such a prude to assume that we could talk to college students about abstaining from fornication, promiscuity, syphilis, and gonorrhea. No, well, that's so 1950s. Are you from Father Knows Best or something? Anyway, these idiots are condemning these poor, hapless, foolish children who don't understand how they're ruining themselves and their psyches and their spirits and their souls through rampant promiscuity, but their mom and dads who run the university system, not their actual mom and dads, but the people who should be in the position of guiding these students, they want to tell them how to figure out how to say yes and yes and how to not be drunk, too drunk, how drunk is too drunk, and when no is too no. But nobody wants to tell them that you should just really keep your pants on. Don't have sex until you get married. That's the way God created it. That's what God intends. And if you follow that simple advice that's been true for all of human history, you won't have to worry about texting and litigation and syphilis and gonorrhea and everything else that goes along with old-fashioned fornication.
Your hands to yourself.
I am Doug McBurney, and that is the Georgia Satellite circa 1989. Southern white trash on beer, but making a good point, right? And we sure do appreciate that. Oh, yeah, they're white trash. That's how they describe themselves in an interview. Southern white trash on beer. Anyway, thank you, boys, for that. Now we move into the bad religion file. A federal judge has issued his final ruling in a polygamy case, a polygamy case that strikes down parts of Utah's anti-polygamy law. The judge, a U.S. district judge, ruled that a provision of Utah's law forbidding cohabitation violated the polygamist's freedom of religion. Freedom of religion? I thought for sure he would cite the queers and all the homo marriages. Isn't it interesting how judges love religion when they can use it against the true and living God and to mock him and to strike down, at least in their own minds, his law and his will? They just love religion when they can use it again. He didn't cite the queers, as far as I know. Now, I haven't read his whole ruling, and it's probably, you know, probably dozens of pages the way these judges always just diarrhea of the mouth whenever they make their self-righteous rulings. But apparently he didn't cite all the queers getting married, but we'll have to check on that. It's quite possible he did. I have a note here. Polygamy is a sin. Is it a crime? Gosh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if polygamy is a crime. I know it's a sin because in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul says you should be, you know, married, a husband of one wife. And then I think there's something in Deuteronomy that says you shall not commit adultery, which indicates to me that God never really appreciated polygamy, even though apparently he tolerated it. Anyway, is it a crime? I'm not sure if it's a crime. If it is a crime, what's the punishment? Well, I can tell you what the punishment is. Multiple wives. That's the punishment for polygamy. Can you imagine having like four wives? That's got to be brutal.
What does that mean?
Hey, I'm just telling you, if you have one wife, it's great because you don't have to share your attention or your emotional availability and all of that because it's one person. And even like a guy gets working too much or he's traveling too much, and that can annoy the wife. She gets annoyed because she's not getting the attention she needs. She's not getting all her needs fulfilled. Well, now you go and you marry two, three, four different women. You're in for a punishment. Your life is a punishment, I can assure you. And you deserve it. I think in this day and age, you deserve all of the angst and deep-seated, seething, bubbling, just under the surface hatred that goes on in your life every day. Which, this is about a specific polygamous couple, but I didn't want to give him any publicity, you know. But anyway, that guy, he acts all like everything's happy. But when those women give each other looks out of their side of their eye, you can see the darts just fire. Right? Have you seen? I mean it. You know it. You know what's going on behind the scenes. They hate each other.
They said they're friends.
Oh, yeah. They're so friendly, I'm sure. All right. Now, we move into the personhood file quickly. An article in Breitbart says, personhood threatens to swamp the chances of the Republicans to capture the Senate by possibly derailing the candidacy of Cory Gardner in Colorado, and they're all upset. They say it's not Cory Gardner's hapless, moronic, half-baked campaign that's going to, you know, lose it for him. It's personhood. U.S. Congress, according to Breitbart, the U.S. Congress and George Bush signed a Federal Unborn Victims of Violence Act, which makes it a felony to harm an unborn child. But in order to pass it, and in order for it to pass constitutional muster, each of the Unborn Victims of Violence Act that have been instituted across America explicitly exempt abortion, which means these are laws written by pro-lifers that make abortion legal. You see, when the Supreme Court ruled that a woman's a privacy right and they had a right to access to abortion, there was never a law on the books that said you could do that. People were just doing it. And the Supreme Court said it was okay, so people started turning a blind eye. And then pro-lifers abandoned personhood, and then it was pro-lifers who started writing the actual laws that actually regulate and make abortion legal. And a lot of these Unborn Victims of Violence Act are just that. What's the problem with Colorado's Amendment 67 this year? Well, it's different. It does not include an exception for abortion, because in Colorado, we're actually serious about everyone's right, every innocent person's right to life. Well, we have a quote here from Steve Ertelt, loser of the culture war and pro-life industry hack. He says, well, if the personhood amendment were approved, miraculously approved, well, it'd be overturned in court and it would not be upheld by the Supreme Court, so we shouldn't even try. Well, it's just crazy. Well, I want to move on. That's Steven Ertelt, who I had a little interaction with on a blog this week. What a loser. He says, we pro-life leaders, we're opposed to personhood because we believe it has little chance of winning. Can't win. It'll be overturned in court. And these campaigns divert huge amounts of cash and attention to what has always turned out to be a losing effort. We're going to lose. You get overturned in court. You need to go with my regulations, says Steven Ertelt. Well, just this week, CNN reports that a federal judge on Friday ruled throwing out key components of abortion regulations that would have forced the closure of a number of abortion facilities there in the state of Texas. That's right. The judge wrote that forcing the clinics to meet some standards, the same standards as hospital-level surgical centers, imposes an undue burden on women who want to kill their babies. And so the judge threw out all the regulations that pro-lifers like Steven Ertelt wrote. How to kill a baby properly. Well, you need to be a ambulatory surgical center, and you need to be approved. You need to have privileges at the hospital, and then you can kill those babies. Well, the judge just threw all that out, Steve. And guess what we're debating on the heels of the judge throwing that out, Steve? We're debating how can we write regulations so that we can kill children properly in a well-regulated environment. That's what we're debating after the judge throws out your regulations, Steve, the regulations you and your ilk at National Right to Life wrote. Well, Steve, I could say to you that you should have never tried it because it's just going to get overturned in court, Steve. You can't win. Well, Steve, you can't legalize murder and then insist people follow your rules on it. Because people who are engaged in murder do not generally follow rules. They're already breaking one of the Big Ten, Steve. Now, if personhood passes in Colorado, Mr. Ertelt, I agree with you. It will almost immediately be overturned in court. But what will we be debating on the morning after that? We will not be debating how to regulate the murder of innocent people. We will be debating whether or not an unborn child is a person. And everyone in the United States of America, everyone who hears the news coverage across the world, will be forced to consider that question, Steve. Is it a human being? Does it have a right to life? Is it a person? Not, should abortionists have ambulatory surgical centers that are certified? Should they have admitting privileges at a local hospital? Maybe there's another regulation. That's what they're debating after your pathetic, hapless loser move, Steve. After our move, we will be debating whether or not it is a person. And all of you pro-life industry hacks, your political bodies will fall in the wilderness as other people who more deserving than you take from you the movement that you squandered and lost. So just get out with that, Steve Ertelt. All right. I think I'm a little upset. Mm-hmm. I need to calm down. Steve Ertelt is one of the most active attackers of personhood that there is. And he regularly accuses us, like he did in a blog exchange this week, he accuses us of being part of the abortion industry, saying that we should be happy that abortion regulations are closing clinics at record levels. Well, guess what, Steve? They're not all of a sudden, are they? Because the judge threw out your regulations. Because they're already murderers, Steve. We need to tell them to stop murdering. We don't need to tell them how to do it. For crying out loud. Anyway, let's move on. Joel Osteen's wife, oh boy. Back into the bad religion file. Joel Osteen, we move from the bad religion of Steve Ertelt, who probably is some kind of Christian. Probably. I'd have to sit down with him and talk with him, though. As of now, I'll assume that he probably needs some guidance. But now, Joel Osteen's wife, on the other hand, I have no doubt that she's going straight to hell with Jet Rockets right along with Joel. Is it bad for me to say that, to assume that? Well, you know, I always assume. I give people the benefit of the doubt. If you speak blasphemous words, I'll assume you're going to hell and I'll try to help you out. So what did she say this week, Joel Osteen's wife? While he was standing next to her, she was preaching in front of the congregation there, and he was nodding his head yes, like a puppet. And here's what's his wife's name, Victoria Osteen, said, quote, "So, you want to know this morning? Just do good for your own self. Do good because God wants you to be happy. When you come to church, when you worship Him, you're not doing it for God, really. You're doing it for yourself because that's what makes God happy. Amen. Can I get an amen?"
Oh, my God.
I know. And now you have a number of people here. Steve Camp, the pastor of a church in Palm City, who criticizes. Eric Erickson, editor-in-chief of... Anyway, you have some criticisms of Victoria's words here that they really miss the point, you know, and you know, I agree that God doesn't really need us to worship Him so that He can be fulfilled. That's certainly, I don't think God needs us. If he doesn't use you, I'm talking to you who's listening to the show right now. If God doesn't use you, He's going to go find somebody else. But to say that we worship Him for ourselves is, I mean, that's just, yeah, that's blasphemy. And it tells me she doesn't understand the gospel. She doesn't understand the body of Christ. She doesn't understand salvation. And she's leading 25,000 people, I mean, into confusion. Let's not say to hell, to confusion. I think the best criticism of Mrs. Osteen, I'm falling into my father's habit. If there's someone you don't like, you mispronounce their name. My father used to do that all the time with my friends. My friends that he didn't like, he would mispronounce their name, and he would always do it. And even though I knew, he knew he was doing it. And so I have this thing with Joel Osteen. I want to call him Joel Osteen. I can't help it. It's genetic. I got it from my dad. Anyway, I think the best criticism of Victoria Osteen was expressed by Michael David Fletcher, a 30-year-old man who entered the bookstore at Lakewood Church and began knocking books off the shelves, throwing books, and overturning display stands, all the while quoting Matthew 21:12, Jesus entered the temple courts and drove out all those who were buying and selling and overturned the tables of the money changers. Anyway, I don't know. All these other guys, I mean, they make interesting points, but this Michael David Fletcher, I like his style. I like that. All right, so that's it for the Bad Religion File. We're just about out of time. Oh, I got one more from the Bad Religion File here. Prescott, Arizona police say that Eric Mineral was seen standing on the steps of Gospel Rescue Mission there in Prescott, Arizona, wearing a long black and red robe and a pentagram necklace. Now, police officers say they noticed a Bible, which was wet and appeared to have been burnt on the ground next to Mr. Mineral. And Mineral admitted to burning the Bible and even urinating on it. He said that he chose the mission because he believed it was a place of Christian worship and that he was cursing the Christians by burning their Bible and then urinating on it. Well, that's not a very good plan. If you're going to burn a Bible, you don't want to urinate on it. And if you're going to urinate on a Bible, it's going to make it really hard to burn. When officers asked Mr. Mineral why he was burning and urinating on the Bible, he said, "Because I am the Dark Lord," he said. That's loosely translated, "I'm on crystal meth." Anyway, listen to this. This is why I got this story. He was arrested for unlawful symbol burning. Symbol burning? The Bible, is it just a symbol? He was burning a Bible. That is about burning a symbol. He was burning a Bible. The Bible's a lot more than a symbol, but the local officials, state and government, state, federal, local, they're all utterly godless anymore. Even the local sheriff in Prescott, Arizona, the local legislature there, can't arrest someone for simply starting a fire and putting other people in danger. They have to say he burned a symbol, and the Bible's not a symbol. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, the United States Forest Service, according to TheBlaze.com, has published a 700-word article on how to safely roast marshmallows in preparation for National Roasted Marshmallow Day, which was yesterday. I wasn't aware. We missed it. National Marshmallow Day, a nearly 700-word article on how to safely roast marshmallows. And I think Mr. Mineral, the Dark Lord, would suggest that you don't urinate on them first, at least. And that's all we've got. That's the Weekly Worldview for this week. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank my friends at KGOV.com, at Denver Bible Church, at TheologyOnline.com, he said. And, of course, my friends at American Right to Life. And, as always, my other brother, Darrell, who makes it all happen here in the Weekly Worldview Studios. Should the Lord tarry, I will return next week. And until then, may the grace of God go with you, and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.